heard good things about this new mic, so let's see. Before she received an NEA fellowship in translation, before her collection of short stories, The Dog Eater, won the AWP Short Fiction Award, and before her recently reissued memoir, Space, won the Alex Award from the American Library Association, Jessie Lee Kercheval was working on a BA in history right here in Tallahassee. Employed, as she writes in her memoir, in an endless round of minimum wage jobs, delivering phone books, selling shrubberies at a nursery, ringing a bell for the Salvation Army one Christmas when they had run short of bums and believers. She claims that during that time here at FSU, her mother would have said that she was smart, but in ways that didn't do her or anybody else much good. So y'all, there's hope. There's hope out there. But it was enough to get her through David Kirby's poetic technique class, as well as writing classes from Burroway and Stern. Later, she'd go on to found the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and direct the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing. The New York Times has called her memoir a quietly powerful personal history and relentlessly unsentimental. But you didn't come here to hear me talk about her. You came here to hear her. So please help me in welcoming poet, fiction writer, memoirist, and translator, Jessie Lee Kercheval.
I'm short, like really short. Can you hear me? Okay. You know, I haven't been in Tallahassee in a long time. I'm kind of not really remembering how long, but a long time, but the warehouse has not changed at all. Except the last time I was here, it was not so cold. You might blame me for that, because I came from Wisconsin where it is like sub-zero. I'm going to read four poems, and then I'm going to read some prose from my memoir. And what I'm going to read first actually is one of my poems. I fell in love with the South American country, which I call Uruguay, and you call Uruguay. So I've been spending a lot of time there, and I actually wrote a collection of poems in Spanish, which were published down there. And then my very first work translating was translating them into English, because I wanted to have them published here. So when the book was published down there, the publisher thought it would be interesting to publish it bilingually. So it's actually Spanish on one side and English on the other. And so the weird thing is I wrote the Spanish first and then I had to translate it into English, which at first I found really hard, actually. I actually sort of my own poems had to kind of Google translated, but I got better at it. And I'm going to read one poem about being at the beach in Uruguay. It's actually summer there now because they're on the other side of the world. And this poem leads into the poems I'm going to read afterwards. It's called Atlantida, Uruguay. In this corner of the world, in this corner where two dusty roads meet, in this corner of a house with a thatched roof that was built as a gas station before there was a national highway, in a living room big enough to park four cars where there is only a hammock and a table, I sit on a late summer afternoon and write these words. In her bed, the grandmother of the house is sleeping. The others have gone to the beach to sunbathe or swim in the sea, but not me, and not the two dogs of the house asleep at my feet or the cat sleeping at my side. The flies on the table sleep too and dream of the food that will be served for dinner. My eyes begin to close. In a moment, I will sleep like my companions and dream of I know not what. The oceans that cover two-thirds of the world, or the fish in the sea more numerous than the stars in the sky, or the theories of philosophers, or simply of dinner, like the flies. And I wanted to start with that because at that very instant when I was staying at Atlante de Uruguay, which is a sort of beach community out of the main city, it was Three Kings. And the tradition in Uruguay is you put your shoes out with some straw for the camels, and the Three Kings bring a gift. And my friends left the issues for kids, but in that family, everyone did it. And the Carlos, my friend, the father of the family, got a ukulele. And I got a copy of the collected poems of Circe Maya. And I sort of sat at the beach, and I read these wonderful poems by this woman who is from Tacuarembó, which is kind of, the very definition of the middle of nowhere in Uruguay. It's about 5 hours from the coast by Brazil. And I just loved them, and I came home, and I was sure that all of them would have been translated into English. This is really quite a big deal in Uruguay, and none of them had been translated into English. So I had, a mission. I wanted to translate her work and make it better known, and I did that, and then this book just came out from the University of Pittsburgh Press, which is called The Invisible Bridge, El Puente Invisible, The Selected Poems of Circe Maya. I started wanting to translate her poems. I when I found out none of them were available in the United States, really, except just a few in old anthologies, I asked someone in Uruguay for her if they knew how to get in touch with her. And Uruguay is a country of 3 million people in which everyone knows everyone. So the first person I asked said, "Oh, of course, here's her email address." And I wrote to her, and she said, "Oh, that would be lovely." And I started translating things, so I wanted to send them to magazines. And then the next time I was down there, I took the 5-hour bus ride to Tacuarembó, a place many people in Uruguay have never been, and met her, and she was literally the most wonderful, most luminous person I've ever met. And so I'm going to read 3 of her poems. One of them was in The New Yorker, which just have to be the highlight of my life. And it's called Hummingbirds. I thought she was exaggerating a little when she said that every one of her hummingbirds, and she had 5, had a distinct name, and that they flew freely in her garden where they had distinct feeders. If not, they fight too much. But it was like that, just like that. I saw them once when the house alone invited a visit to the open back garden. There they came, flying like tiny winged messengers with urgent notices and warnings. No name fit them well, useless words. Astonishment at the rapid movement of the wings, the not being able to look at them, the approach of their tiny hearts beating so incredibly rapidly, close, very close, and then suddenly shooting off high, unattainable, beings of our world, but also of another, only theirs. And then Circe also writes other poems. They're often very short philosophical poems. She was a philosophy teacher all of her life. In Uruguay, you actually take philosophy. It's a required subject in high school. I know that now that my son was in high school for 2 years down there. Otherwise, I thought, really? They have high school philosophy teachers? And there are some poems of hers that are really quite dark because there was a military dictatorship in Uruguay in the 80s, about the same time there was in pretty much all of South America, and her husband was in prison. Actually, the military police broke into their house to arrest them, and they were going to arrest her, and she had just given birth to her youngest daughter. She has 6 daughters, and so they left her, and they took her husband to prison, which actually is the difference between Uruguay and Argentina, because in Argentina, they would have taken them both and taken the baby away. But that wasn't much compensation. So here's a poem that she wrote when her husband was in prison. It's called Treason. The last son did not say to him, "I am the last son." Nothing prepared him. The water slid over his body, and he didn't know that this was the way that the water said goodbye. He did not know. No one told him anything. When night came, it came to stay, and he never knew. Actually, Ariel, her husband, was released from prison. He didn't die in prison, and he's still alive today, a retired doctor. But it was a tough time. And I'm going to read one last poem, which I like as a poem of a poet actually talking to their reader, and also because it has a reference to Circe Maya's garden. And if you can imagine that sort of wonderful scene where I'm sitting at the beach in Atlántida, Circe's garden is also this special place. So she has a walled garden, like many Uruguayans do, behind their house, where she has like lemon trees. And whenever I go to Tacuarembó, we go and sit in the garden and read poetry and talk. And this poem is called Invitation. I would like you to hear my voice. Wish I could hear yours. Yes, yes, I am talking to you, silent gaze that runs over these lines. You disapprove, perhaps, of this impossible desire to escape paper and ink. What will we say to each other? I don't know, but it has to be better than always talking to myself, turning phrases, sounds, placing and removing parentheses, and putting them in again. If your voice interrupts and breaks this very line, come in. I was waiting for you. This way. Let's go into the garden. There are fruit trees. You will see. Come. So now I'm switching poetry hats for prose hats. So before I was a translator, actually the very first thing I was probably a fiction writer, although I did take poetry and fiction when I was both here. And I grew up in Florida, but forever I just didn't write about it. I wrote stories about other things I made up. And it wasn't until later that I decided that I was going to write a memoir. And then I was sort of glad that I hadn't used my childhood, which was growing up down by Cape Canaveral, the Kennedy Space Center in Cocoa, Florida, for early stories, because the memories were there sort of untouched. And this memoir came out a while ago, but this last year, the University of Wisconsin Press reissued it. And so I had another round of doing readings from it, which is kind of interesting, because it's my life, and yet I'd forgotten some of the things that were in the book. I'm actually going to read two small sections that are rather further on in the book. I moved to Florida in 1968 when I was 10. With my mother and father. My father was a community college administrator, so he's like the only person in Cocoa, Florida who didn't work at the Cape, the only dad. And my mother had been a school teacher. And then I was there with my only sister, Carol. And this one starts, the chapter's titled December 1972. My sister Carol and I are on the roof waiting for the moon rocket to blast off. This is not a dream or a science fiction story. We are staying up to see Apollo 17, the last lunar mission and the only one to leave the Earth at night. It is pitch black. It is supposed to go up at 10 and then around 11, but the countdown keeps getting stopped, the launch time delayed. At first, mothers as well as kids are on top of the other houses in our neighborhood. Most of the fathers are at the Cape trying to get the rocket up. By the third time the radio announces the countdown has stopped, the mothers are gone, sure the mission is scrubbed. But up on the roof, the countdown resumes. I think about our mother, asleep right under my butt. Although it's past midnight, my father is still at the office, working late as usual on some interminable report. I close my eyes and imagine my parents' dark cherrywood bed, my mother completely unnaturally still. When we were little, she used to yell in her sleep, "No, no, no." By this night, she's not only on Valium, she is mixing it with bourbon, and so she doesn't do that, or much else, anymore. At 12:30, Carol says she is giving up. She hates staying up late. I beg her to stay, afraid I will have to go too. I am 16, not a little kid anymore, but still, she thinks she is my mother, or at least, she thinks somebody should be. She opens her mouth to say something. Yes, I will stay. No, I won't. But I realize I can see her mouth, and I wonder where the light is coming from, and in the same instant, I know. The rocket is blasting off, rising over the river like the sun, that bright. I look at the orange trees and see colors, green leaves, waxy white blossoms, yellow fruit sooty with mildew. Above the flame, the sky turns a perfect ordinary blue. Birds begin to sing. Somewhere a dog barks. Then the sound hits, a roar so loud it makes my bones itch, louder than any rock concert I have yet been allowed to go to. Carol and I are on our feet, hugging each other on the gently sloping roof. She is shouting and I am shouting, though we can't hear our own voices. The red and gold trail burns through the sky and we track it with our eyes. Our bodies lean forward, longing to follow, but we can't. We are not old enough or strong enough or desperate enough to break free. Gravity will not let us go, not yet. In the fading light, as the rocket passes downrange, we see who is on the next roof, David Mize and the Hecht boys, one my age, one older than Carol. Over them is a cloud of smoke. They are smiling and waving a bottle at us. They are obviously stoned. All over Brevard County, people are either stoned or selling or sorting or smuggling pot. Our senior class president has just been arrested for dealing, although he had to go to Orlando to get busted. No one ever seems to get arrested in Cocoa. At that moment, Brevard County is the drug smuggling capital of Florida, maybe the drug capital of the United States, but I have never smoked pot or even a cigarette, and that is Carol's doing. Oh, it's just Jesse Lee, I hear one of them say my name, mocking me for not being with them. I've already gone through my first 2 years of high school without being allowed in the restroom, Dealer's Central, but they don't mock Carol. She does not drink, smoke, take drugs, or chew gum, and they respect the fierceness of her convictions. All those things are bad for your voice, and she is serious about her voice. Carol starts to lift her hand way back. Then as the roar fades, she doesn't, and the light fades. We get down off the roof and back into the air-conditioned silence of the house where our mother is sleeping. Carol is shaking her head, her long, arched nose a study in determination. I think her nose is beautiful. I think she is beautiful and strong. She is the one who demands that we act like a family, put up a Christmas tree, eat in the dining room on Thanksgiving, when my father would rather stay in his office, I in my room, my mother in her bed. At that moment, I love her more than anything in the world. Remember, she says, in our family, we don't do things like that. And then we start to do things like that. My sister, who had been was in chorus, has a humiliating experience being in the high school performance of Oklahoma, and she goes out and she gets terribly drunk. And so I go out with a friend and I get stoned. And then after my sister had got terribly drunk, she had her wisdom teeth taken out and started feeling badly. The doctors had called over some medication. So I go out with this friend and I get stoned. And I come back to the house, and this is where we are. We pulled up in front of the house on the motorcycle. I got off, my legs unsteady. I took off a helmet, and he strapped, and Mark, the friend I had gone smoking with, strapped it on the bike at the back of the bike. I thought he was going to say something like, "If you need me, you know where to find me." But he didn't say anything, and then he roared away. I stood in the hot sun on my driveway, my hair in my eyes. I tried to run my hand through it, but the hair was so tangled that my fingers got nowhere. Now I was ready to talk to Carol. I brushed the sand off my legs and I went inside. It was dark and cool as always, but not quiet this time. My parents were in the kitchen arguing. "I don't want to call Dr. Bach's service again," my mother was saying. She sounded like she'd been crying. "You don't know what it's like. I call and I call. He ignores me." "But this isn't for you. Didn't you say it was about Carol?" my father said. I slammed the front door and coughed. "Jesse?" I heard Carol calling, but her voice sounded strange, like her head was under the covers. "Jess, please." I walked down the hall and I opened her door, and what I saw was so strange that I thought it couldn't be real. I shook my head. It didn't go away. Carol was lying on her bed, but her back was impossibly arched, her face twisted. Only the tip of her head and her heels were actually touching the mattress. Even from across the room, I could smell her sweat and her fear. She was having some kind of convulsion. "God," I said, running to her. I tried to push her down on the bed. How could I have doubted her when she told me how bad she felt? "Please," she hissed between clenched teeth, "get me out of here. Get me out of here, out of this house, this family." I felt ashamed. Even Carol had given up on us. I ran to the phone and called an ambulance, using the number from the orange emergency sticker on the receiver. My parents were still arguing like children. "You call, no, you call." I wanted to scream at them. Instead, I just told them what I had done. By the time the ambulance attendants arrived, Mom and Dad were grown up again. They acted like parents and asked questions. An attendant said the muscle seizures might be an allergic reaction to Compazine, the anti-nausea drug the doctor had prescribed. A pretty common one. Allergic reaction, of course. Carol was allergic to everything. "Is she going to die?" I asked. I said this so they would say, "Oh, heavens, no." Instead, one of them said, "It's best not to think of that right now." And they put an oxygen mask on Carol and shot something into her arm. She relaxed a little and turned her head away from my parents, and she looked at me, and I leaned closer, and she said something I couldn't quite catch. "Mad at you," was what it sounded like. "Am mad at you? Am not mad at you?" Either way, I was sure she knew everything. She's either blaming me or forgiving me for what I'd been doing all afternoon. My parents climbed into the back of the ambulance with Carol, serious adult, my mother clutching her purse. The last thing I saw before they closed the back doors were Carol's toes. And as the ambulance started down the driveway, I realized I had no way to get to the hospital. I ran after it, hoping one of the attendants would see me in the rearview mirror and let me sit between them on the front seat. Instead, the driver hit the siren and was gone, and I stopped at the end of the driveway, breathing hard. Just then, a sheriff's car passed, stopped, backed up, and a deputy got out, hitching his belt. At once, I was aware of my matted hair, my sandy clothes, which might or might not smell like pot. "So," he said, "someone here OD'd?" He said the ambulance crew had called in a drug-related incident. At first, I was so furious I couldn't say anything. Then I did, in a torrent. "It wasn't an overdose," I said. "My sister would never do anything like that. It was an allergic reaction to a drug our family doctor had prescribed." The deputy nodded patiently, and I realized he had heard all of this many times before. My mother, full of legally prescribed Valium, could have been unconscious in that ambulance, or Mark could have OD'd, or me. It was all the same to him. I accepted the deputy's offer of a ride to the hospital, but I couldn't shut up. I told him how when we were little, Carol would get so mad at me for reading all the time that she would tear the book from my hands, how I would just pick up another book, and then another, and she would fall on me, punching me and pulling my hair. "She wanted me to play with her," I said. He nodded without taking his eyes from traffic. "Look at me," she used to say, I told him. "She wants people to be there when they're there." "Yeah," he said. "Well," and he shrugged. He dropped me off at the emergency entrance. I saw my parents on the far side of the waiting room, standing closer together than I could ever remember seeing them. I was walking towards them when the double doors next to them swung open and a doctor in green surgical scrubs walked out. My parents turned their backs to me, their faces to him. I strained to hear what he was saying, but he was too far away. But I knew he had to be saying that Carol was dead. The doctor's inaudible words seemed to roll like a wave across the room. Washing over my mother and my father, I saw my mother's hands rise, my father's head snap back. "Tonight, my mother will throw her Valium down the garbage disposal, grind even the plastic bottle to bits. From now on, my father will come home every day at 5. I will hug my mother and listen to my father. We will take up gardening or decoupage or Chinese cooking, some hobby we can all share. The three of us will eat every meal together. It is not too late. We will be a family. For Carol, we will be a family." I braced myself, waiting for the wave to hit me. Instead, I heard my father's irritated voice. "I told you he would be fine," she said to my mother. Carol was not dead. I took a deep breath, prepared to feel joy or at least profound relief. But mostly I felt strange. Like I didn't know these people, like this wasn't my family at all. Thanks.